Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Hi, I'm Sammy, and welcome to episode 5 of Hey Chef. Today, I am talking to iconic Baltimore chef, Jerry Pellegrino. He is currently the owner of Scola, a hands-on cooking school, and the owner of Strickland Hollow Farm and Distillery. We talk about the pandemic's impact on the restaurant industry, discuss his WYPR talk show, Radio Kitchen, learn the science of making hard cider, and more. So, let's get into it. Here is Hey Chef! Hi, Chef. So happy to finally have you on the show.
Yes. It's been a little bit of some obstacles lately.
Yes, definitely. So let's just get right into it. So Scola, your cooking school.
Yes.
Right before the pandemic, I went to Scola and we made Cuban cuisine. We made ropa vieja, which is basically, for people who do not know, it's shredded pork and like a sauce, right? With like beans and rice.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty common dish all around Latin America and the islands. But yeah, it's basically braised beef. It actually literally translates into old rags.
Okay.
Is the sort of the translation. But yeah, it's a pretty common dish. Served over rice everywhere, including Cuba.
Yeah. I read that. Yep. I think it's the national dish.
Yeah, I think in Cuba it certainly is.
Yeah. We also made croquettes. And flan, that was like to die for. That was really good.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun.
Yep. Okay, so what inspired you to start a cooking school in Baltimore?
Well, you know, prior to that, I owned some restaurants. Mm-hmm. And I sort of got a late start in life in terms of restaurateur and being a chef. And so I had the restaurants for about 15 years. And I was getting tired a little bit of sort of the daily grind and the long hours and just a lot of hard work. And so I actually sort of stepped away, kind of put myself into retirement, so to say, for a little while and sat around and figured out what my next move would be. We had always taught a few cooking classes at the restaurants, you know, kind of maybe a couple a month on nights we were closed. And they were always a big success. And I truly like to teach and to be around people who want to learn. So, you know, my partner, Chef Amy Von Lang, and myself had talked about the possibility of a cooking school years before, but in my crazy world of restaurant touring, it didn't make sense. Now that I could devote some time to it, it seemed like a pretty logical progression, the next move. And so I guess about 5 years ago in June, we pulled the trigger, and nice. We've been having a grand time ever since.
Awesome. Yeah, and obviously you teach dishes from around the world, which I absolutely love. I love to make tequenos, mochi, sushi, you know, things for all around the world, empanadas. So why did you decide to use global cuisine at your school?
Well, we teach over 300 different classes at the school. There's a whole technique series, you know, which focuses on specific techniques such as making pasta or baking bread or making sushi. But there also is an entire regional series of cuisines from around the world. And so that, the Cuban class fits into that series, which, you know, which is great. I mean, a lot of people want to learn about the different cuisines and ingredients and techniques that people use globally.
So do you have a favorite cuisine?
Well, you know, the last name Pellegrino, it's kind of hard to say that I don't love Italian food. I think I'd get my Italian card taken away if I didn't say that. But it's been a great experience. I think when you're a chef and you own a restaurant, or if you were, say, the chef at a restaurant, usually a restaurant has a specific focus, whether it be French or Italian or modern American or whatever. You do that almost in a Groundhog Day type of way, you know, every day, every meal. It was great. I think I've learned more in the 5 years we've owned Scola than in the 15 years I was a chef and a restaurateur, because you don't tend to look outside of the box that your restaurant is stuck in. And so it's been a lot of fun to explore all these different things, which I really never got to do, you know, before. So it's been great.
Awesome. So you've been a chef in Baltimore for a long time, like 15 years. Can you tell me about your time here as a chef?
So I guess I started working in restaurants in 1995 and opened my first one, which was Cork's in 1997. Mm-hmm. Back then, there weren't a lot of us. There were, Baltimore had a handful of continental old standbys, Chesapeake House, Gampy's, the Polo Grill, a few steakhouses like the Prime Rib, mm-hmm. Marconi's. I know I feel bad if Morris Martix. Those were sort of old style continental cuisine restaurants that were great. I mean, people in Baltimore loved them. They mm-hmm. they often focused on large portions, which was something not just in Baltimore, but back then people going out to restaurants thought was a staple of a good place.
Yeah.
And then a few of us kind of came along. There was Spike Jurdy at Spike and Charlie's, and Tony Foreman and Cindy Wolf, who actually had Savannah back then, myself. We started doing a more modern type of cuisine. Those old school restaurants, they did what we call Chinette plating. Mm-hmm. If you know the old paper plates, the Chinette plates with three compartments, uh-huh. there was a big one for the protein and then one for the starch and one for the vegetable, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of the cuisine back then. It was, I call it Chinette food. We started making smaller portions and making more intricate plate presentations, mm-hmm. which we, by the way, got criticized for early on. Mm-hmm. There are some articles that were written in back in the late 90s about how portions are small and how, you know, food is fanciful. We also, back then, there weren't any restaurants really focusing on wine. And so the three of us, we actually had very serious wine lists that were devoid of the mainstream, you know, Mondavi, Gallo, Dubuff. Not that they're bad wines. They're good wines that were easy to write a wine list. But we also struck out and tried to support smaller, now the buzzwords would be handcrafted artisanal producers. And then we had large lists that had great wines. And so that was in the 90s. That obviously now there are 100 places like that in Baltimore. A lot of the people owning and running them worked for one of the three of us or all of us at one mm-hmm. point. The food scene in Baltimore has evolved dramatically. I mean, there's the type of place I was describing. There's a bunch of them in every neighborhood around the city, including mm-hmm. neighborhoods that I didn't even know existed back then, mm-hmm. like Station North and all these places. So anyway, it's been fun to watch the scene grow up a bit.
Yeah. So obviously you really helped start the Baltimore food scene.
A little bit, you know, that's what people say. We were just having fun cooking and staying up late night and chatting with each other over wine.
Yeah. That sounds like fun. Well, obviously I can't drink wine.
Not yet. You will.
So I read that you're from New York. I love the New York food scene.
Yes.
I'm sure you probably do as well. Like great restaurants like 11 Madison Park, La Bernardine, and so on, like Per Se. So why did you come to Baltimore to start having restaurants there?
You know, my original career path, I was originally a molecular geneticist. I was mm-hmm. a scientist. And I went to Johns Hopkins and was at the med school studying for my PhD. Mm-hmm. That's why I moved to Baltimore. I at that point, I was... we say I was in the restaurant business, but I was on the consumer side back then. I wasn't involved and I wasn't even thinking about having a restaurant when I came to Baltimore in 1988 to start at Hopkins.
Okay.
It was only over the 6 years that I spent at Hopkins that I slowly found out that my hobby, which was eating and drinking, mm-hmm. eventually became my passion and my career path, and my love of science became more of my hobby. And so I was already in Baltimore and, actually really love the city and still do. I mean, I've been there over 30 years now, and Although I don't live there full time anymore, I still have my home there in Federal Hill, and I still have the cooking school and still go back, you know, all the time to spend time in the city and eat out at all the cool places that are now popping up around the city.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm also interested in science, like microbiology specifically. Like,
sure.
If people who don't know, like bacteria, microbes, viruses, and I like to apply that into fermentation, like kombucha and pickles and other fermented vegetables.
Sure. Yeah.
So I read that you brew hard cider. Is that similar to like kombucha where there's like a mother, or can you explain the process?
Well, I mean, up here in the Catskills, we own a cider apple farm, mm-hmm. and we grow cider apples, and we also own a distillery. Mm-hmm. And so the first part of distilling things we make, which are apple brandy, we make apple grappa, and we make pomo. Mm-hmm. The first step is to take, harvest the apples and press the juice and ferment that into a hard cider. And so it's basically the same process that you use to make wine, except you're starting with grapes, or to make beer, except you're starting with grain. It's just the fermentation pathway of yeast converting sugar into carbon dioxide and ethanol. And mm-hmm. a mother is not exactly what we would call it. It's more of... it's more of just adding yeast. We culture our own yeast, but it's just fermentation at its best.
Cool. So you're talking about brandy and a few other ones I don't remember, but what are the differences between them?
Well, so what we make is a Calvados style apple brandy. And what mm-hmm. that is it's the juice of the apples fermented into cider and then distilled and aged in oak for two to four years. That's the first thing we make. We make what the government wants to call a pumice brandy, but if you were in Italy, it'd probably be called grappa, which is after we press the grapes, we take the solids, which now don't have any juice because we've pressed that out to make the cider, and we re-ferment the solids and re-press them and distill that into pumice brandy or an apple grappa that we age in oak. And then pomo that we make is basically the exact same thing as port, but with apples instead of grapes. It's basically apple juice that's fortified with a distilled spirit, which we make from apple solids. And that's a dessert style wine. Pomo is, since it's juice fortified, it's has its natural sweetness from the apples. And so it's about 20% alcohol as opposed to the brandy, which is 40% alcohol.
Oh, okay.
And it's usually drank after dinner, although I enjoy a little bit before dinner also. So those are the three things we make. And we also make gin from the sap of all the 100-year-old maple trees on the property. So we have a substantial maple grove, and we harvest sap from those guys in March and April, late March, early April. And then we distill that and make gin out of that. So we make gin also.
Awesome. I can see behind you.
Yes.
Huge tanks and pipes and like a
those are the stills and some of the barrels. It's the most quiet place on the farm is to be sitting in the distillery. So that's where I like to do these Zoom things. But yes, to I guess my right, which would be your left, that is a big pot still. That's what we make the brandy out of. This
awesome.
This column still behind me is where we make the gin and the grappa, and that's one of the barrels. That's a stack of barrels over there.
Wow.
There's some
huge
stacks everywhere else around the distillery full of spirit aging in the barrels.
Obviously, people who are listening can't really see that, but like huge oak barrels lined and stacked on each other. Looks awesome. So,
it's a fun place to be for sure.
Awesome. So obviously you have an apple orchard. Do you grow anything else?
We've got 10 blueberry bushes and a substantial vegetable garden, but that's purely for home use. The commercial part of the project is cider apples. We have about 320 trees on a 1.5-acre orchard that are new, and then we have 400-year-old trees on an acre orchard in the back of the property that obviously we didn't plant, but we inherited when we bought the farm. Mm-hmm. And they're part of our program also. They're great apples.
Mm-hmm. Do they all produce?
So apples tend to be a little biannual. So trees, especially the bigger, older ones, don't tend to produce every year. They produce every other year. So, but they're not in sync.
Okay.
We get apples. It's not like one year they all don't make them and the next year they all do. Some do, some don't. So we harvest anywhere from 2 to 4,000 pounds.
Dang.
Annually. And we do, for the Pomo, not to get too complicated, we do buy the Pomo. We buy apples from our friend down the road at Stoneline Orchard. He has, his David and Missy, those guys have a great modern cider apple orchard that we buy, fruit from those guys too, when we make our products.
Cool. So is there anything very interesting in your garden this year?
Well, yeah, we grow all the staples. I don't know. I mean, in the old days, it might be interesting, but nowadays everybody knows what heirloom varieties and all sorts of things are. You know, we have a big herb garden, you know, standard stuff in the spring and fall, radishes, lettuces, turnips, zucchini, tomatoes, eggplant, all different types of peppers, you know, the whole nine yards.
Nice. What's your favorite time of year for produce?
Oh, I love all the seasons. I think one of the things, not to harp on the old days, or you know, back in the old restaurants, they had the same menu, you know, the whole year.
Yeah.
And of course, even though I think it's the beautiful thing about steakhouses, you know, they have the same menu for 30 years, never changed the menu. But, you know, a lot of us started thinking about cooking seasonally. And I think, you know, I don't think I could be a chef in one of those restaurants where the menu never changed. It's like Bill Murray and Groundhog Day, just too much.
Yeah.
So I think the beauty of seasons is that just as you're getting super tired of one thing, it's time for it to go away and something else comes around. And so I think I get excited about the start of each season, and what's coming in the garden. And that makes it fun.
Cool. So I've been listening to your show Radio Kitchen on WIPR. Al Spoeler. And the most recent episode was about cobblers. I actually just made one. I thought it was like
cool.
I've never made one before. I thought it was crazy how you put the batter in the bottom and then the peaches on top and then the batter goes all the way to the top. Like, how does that, do you know how that works?
Do I know how that works? Sure. You know, as the butter in the batter starts to melt, it gives off steam, which also produces air pockets. And that air, just like bubbles in a soda, rises to the top. It pulls, as the dough heats up, it pulls the dough to the top. The whole idea, what's cool about it is it mixes the fruit with the juices that are dripping through the bottom and the cornstarch to give you that lovely thick consistency underneath that crust that's risen to the top, because as hot air rises and the air pockets in the dough rise it up to the top. So just as the souffle rises up from the dish, that dough rises up through the fruit and makes that topping just delicious and lovely. But you get that turbulence as it does it, that mixes everything up and gets a nice thick sauce in the bottom. It's a cool dish.
It really had to be
invented by somebody who made a mistake the first time and realized it worked, no doubt, because there's no way that's how you would do it if you were thinking.
Yeah. Maybe a scientist or something, or maybe just probably an accident, like you said. Back to the show. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
I mean, that show is now in its 19th year on the radio. So we started quite a while ago, but the history of WYPR, which is basically 88.1 FM, used to be WJHU, which was the John Hopkins University's school radio station. And whatever 19 years ago, I don't remember the date, but it was purchased. You know, Hopkins decided they weren't interested in it anymore, and it was purchased by an independent group who wanted to focus on local content. Public radio, you have the option of buying sort of national content, and YPR still does. You know, the national shows like All Things Considered and you know, what used to be Car Talk, but those types of shows, they're all purchased. But you also have the option to publish local content. And Hopkins had sort of let the station just become 100% purchased content, except for actually Mark Steiner's show during the day and Andy Beanstalk's jazz show at night, and maybe a few others. I'm apologize if I'm leaving a few others out, but that was it. And then when the new group took over, they wanted to focus on local content. So they launched all these local shows, and Al had already been doing a show with Hugh Sisson on YPR called Cellar Notes. And Al asked me, Al and I had become friends over the years because he was a regular at the restaurant.
Okay.
I said, hey, looks like we're going to do some local content. Would you like to do the show with me? And I said, sure, that'd be great. So, you know, fast forward 19 years, Al and I are still doing it.
Wow.
So it's fun. That's this history. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So you said you love eating and drinking wine. Where did that love come from?
Well, you know, back to my Italian heritage, my father went to work and my mother was a stay-at-home mom. And we obviously, when dad got home, my sister, mom, and dad and I all sat down to eat. We ate dinner together pretty much every night. My parents always drank wine at the table. back then, it was what, you know, most families, Italian families drank. It was jug wine, you know, big or Gallo Hardy Burgundy or Carlo Rossi. You know, they each had one glass with dinner. My dad's glass was like a 32-ounce goblet. You know, my mom's glass was like 24 ounces. But they each only had one of those.
Okay.
And we ate dinner. And slowly but surely, I realized that the idea of sitting down to eat together is not just about the food, but it's about sticking, you know, together as a family and having a time when you can talk and you know, work out any issues and get advice or get in arguments or, you know, learn new things. And so food to me has always been not just to keep, you know, energy in my body. It's always been a reason to sit down and spend time with family and friends. And of course, wine started to play a big part in that as I got older and started to realize that wine, a lot of wine's not in a gallon jug. It's in a 750 ml bottle and it has a cork in it. Then it all of a sudden the world changed because studying wine, drinking wine is, it can be, it doesn't have to be. Let me be very clear that it's all good to just open wine and anytime and drink it without worrying about what it is. But if one wants, it can be an extremely intellectual pursuit.
Yeah.
You know, in every bottle of wine, there's biochemistry, there's botany, there's geology, there's often politics, religion, geography, climatology, all sorts of these things that each bottle of wine contains. And so for me, it really started to become an incredibly intellectual pursuit. I was, before I was at Hopkins, I was at Boston College getting my master's in developmental biology and, as a grad student, you get a stipend, you don't really have much money to spend, but I ended up cooking at home a lot, but I also like to go out and buy wine. And what I started doing was going to a wine store and buying a bottle of wine that I really didn't understand any of the words on the label. And I would bring it home and I would look it up in one of my wine books and find out where, what the region was, what was all about, what the grapes were in the bottle. And, I would just sort of continue to buy wines from that region and drink them until I felt I had a great grasp about that region. And then I would start the process over. And so in the 2 years I was at Boston College and well into the 6 years I was at Hopkins, I basically drank my way around the world and tried to, you know, figure it all out. And so by the time I was ready to open my restaurant, I had a pretty good knowledge, probably way better knowledge of wine than actually of being a chef. And thanks to guys like Rob Klink and Johnny Collins, who were the original chef and sous chef, and many others who came after them, who really taught me to be a chef, we ended up being successful. But, you know, wine, it's part of being a restaurateur. The whole beverage program is it often equal to the food program. And so very important in terms of your profitability as a restaurateur. So knowing as much about the beverage program as a chef as you do about the food program is crucial to being a successful chef owner of a restaurant, you know, unless you hire someone to manage the program, but it's still really always back to you as the chef owner of making the decisions and deciding what you're gonna put on that beverage list and how you're gonna sell it.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. All about the wine and like the weather too, right? That year it also affects the wine.
Yeah, that's what makes wine complicated. Not only do you have to learn about every region in the world, but every year the whole thing has a reset and things start over. So awesome. Yes, very, very fun to figure it all out.
Cool. And back to your family. Like, what kind of foods did your mom make when you were growing up?
Well, my mother's Sicilian, You know, I come from a mixed marriage, right? My mom's Sicilian and my father's from Naples. So right there, we got a big problem. And also, you know, I grew up in the 70s when it wasn't necessarily cool to be an immigrant. You know, now it's cool to be bilingual and proud of your heritage. In the 70s, you were supposed to be an American. You're supposed to be American. And so I was treated to two types of meals on a regular basis. One would be traditional Italian food that my mother's mother and her mother cooked for her.
Like pasta.
And then
what are you talking?
Yes. Yeah. Risotto, pasta dishes, gnocchi, you know, and it might consider it Mediterranean, you know, meats roasted with fresh herbs and garlic, you know, those types of things. But unfortunately, my mother, you know, wanting to be a American housewife, the other type of meal I was often exposed to was a bunch of crap that she got in all the magazines, like, and it all required like Campbell's cream of mushroom soup as one of the ingredients, you know, so like tuna noodle casserole with cream of celery soup, or one time she made this thing where she put sour cream on chicken and rubbed it in like crushed up Ritz cracker crumbs and baked it. You know, we often were subject to the Chinese food that came in a can that she made rice and poured it over with like the crunchy noodles on top. So those meals were less memorable to me, although certainly was interesting to try them.
Could you tell the difference? Like, did you like one more?
Yeah, of course you can. There's no doubt. And, you know, till this day, I'm pretty down. I'm down with a solid tuna noodle casserole. Don't get me wrong. The Ritz cracker thing, I could be fine never having again. But you know, it's for me, it's more, it feels more like home when I eat more of an Italian or a Mediterranean diet. Anything else, you know, that being said, of course, man, we get sushi when we go out, we go to Korean barbecue. We love all that type of food too. But, that's not what my wife and I and my mom still cooks at home.
Cool. Yeah. So like, did you ever help when you were a kid?
Yeah. And Sunday mornings, my sister and I would make my mom and dad breakfast in bed. You know, we'd get up and we'd make eggs or pancakes or something. Cool. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I was cooking with, you know, the young age. I mean, obviously I didn't really start understanding cooking until I was on my own at college and then, you know, grad school and then Hopkins. When I really was in a kitchen, you know, by myself and doing everything, the shopping, you know, the prepping and the preparation. Yeah. And so, and I did spend time when I was in Boston and early on in my career in Baltimore working, you know, staging on weekends in kitchens for free, you know, going in and chopping vegetables and just being in commercial kitchens just because that, like I said, back then it was more of a hobby and it was fun to do on a Saturday, just go stage in someone's kitchen. I did used to do that, but you know, eventually that morphed into really becoming my career path.
Awesome. Yeah. I love staging as well. I currently staging at Foraged, Chef Chris Amendola.
Yeah. Chris Amendola is a lovely, lovely guy. A very talented chef.
Yeah, he really is. So earlier you mentioned some people who helped you learn how to be a chef. Can you talk about them a little more?
You know, I was fumbling around in kitchens around the city, but nothing that required any real major skill, you know, more like bar food and simple stuff. Opening Corks was a huge jump for me in terms of skill level and what I envisioned executing as what we touted was a modern American menu. And Rob Klink was the first executive chef and Johnny Collins was the sous chef. Those guys had been with Paulie Santi at Champagne Tony's. And I believe Rob is now very high up in the Legal Seafood organization. And I don't know where Johnny ended up. But some other guys who come through my kitchen, those guys, a lot of them have gone on to open their own restaurants or to be chefs in corporate environments. And, you know, those guys were the ones who were, I was giving them the conceptual idea of the dishes and what I wanted, but those guys were really the masters at executing it in the beginning, because I really didn't have the skill set to really do it on my own. That didn't come for a few years later, but those guys were great. And everyone who's been through my kitchen, and there's been many, learning is always a two-way street. The instructor always learns from the student. There's no one way in that environment. So anybody who I've worked with over the years has influenced in some way or another the my cooking and the way I run the restaurant.
Cool. So obviously this topic is huge. The pandemic is drastically affecting the food and restaurant industry, whether it be closing restaurants or like making them earn much less money. So what are your thoughts for how the restaurant industry can survive?
Well, first I'll just tell you, I'm so glad I'm not in it anymore. Because God, it's just really terrible out there for all these folks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard to make money in the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. And that's when you're 100% full all the time. To be closed for that long and then now to be open at some sort of diminished capacity, it's just gotta be really hard. The guys that are surviving are living off their savings accounts or getting these grants or these loan, you know, these payment loan things or those types of things. I mean, nobody is making a profit at this point. They're just not. I mean, so there's by definition is going to be a bunch of attrition. I mean, and that's too bad, you know, in a lot of ways. I also think, you know, just like the stock market, the restaurant scene was getting a little too crowded and could use a real correction to sort of, to get out people who are not really making it for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, that said, I never wish anybody bad in business. Everybody who opens anything puts their heart and soul into it. But, you know, just like me, I just didn't want to be in the restaurant business anymore. And and the restaurant, you know, the performance of the restaurants were probably showing it. And so it's the hardest thing in the world to walk away, but for me, it was the right decision. And I think a lot of people who were on the fence of deciding whether to walk away, this might have helped push a bunch of people over the edge. I can't tell you, not just in the restaurant business, how many older folks I've talked to who have finally retired, even though they probably could have retired a bunch of years ago. They just kept going because they didn't know any different. And now they're so much happier. So there might be a silver lining to this. But, you know, nobody's making any money and we'll see how long people can last. I know that. But a lot of people are evolving. People are now becoming grocery stores almost, you know, selling product and getting things for people. And what, you know, what's great is the public has just been so generous to support a lot of these people.
Yeah.
You know, giving servers much bigger tips. I know that I tip more now. You know, we're a little lucky up here in Catskills. There's very, very few cases of coronavirus in our area. Our county is 14,000 square miles and we have just over 100 cases in the whole county. So we're a little less reluctant to go out to eat. I mean, we still only go where we can sit outside, but I know that we're tipping, you know, these servers, I personally tipping them exorbitant tips just so they can survive because they're not waiting on the number of tables that they normally would, you know, and we try to get out and support as many of the people around here as we can, as often as we can, so that they do have some revenue stream, some cash flow. But we'll see. I mean, I'm not optimistic. I think it's a shitty deal for a lot of people. And, you know, even Scola has been living off its bank account for the last, you know, 5 months. I mean, we haven't been able to do classes and we have been paying our rent and our bills and it's just living off the savings account, you know, the rainy day fund, which, you know, we're starting to get to the point where it's uncomfortable at an uncomfortable level. So we have opened to do some small classes and just to try and start cash flow. But I would love to know, to feel that we're going to have a holiday season like we always have a holiday season. But time goes on, I'm less and less optimistic that that's going to happen. And so a lot of people, they make their big money during the holidays. And if they're not what they could be, I think early 2021 is when we'll see a rash of closings and businesses in general, definitely restaurants just not opening their doors in 2021.
Yeah, this really sucks. Are you scared that the local, I don't know, Mexican restaurant is going to become like a Chipotle in the future?
No, I don't. Corporate restaurants, you know, McDonald's is doing okay because they have a drive-thru, but those sort of chef-driven concepts like Chipotle and all that, where people are scared to go in, they're not doing very well either. I think corporate usually has a much bigger stash of cash, but they also have a way larger number in terms of their operating expenses and their fixed costs. So it's not good for them either. And I think opening a restaurant always seems to be like someone's dream, a lot of people's dream. You talk to a lot of people like, you know, I want to own a restaurant. Of course, the first words out of my mouth are don't. It's a very stupid venture. But once there's all these closures and things start to creep back to normal, you're going to also see another boom in openings of people who are going to sweep in. You know, there's an article that real estate's down 10% in New York City because there's not a lot, you know, a lot of people have left. I mean, I'm guessing that's going to go down again. And so what that allows is an opportunity now for people to come in and sign leases at much less money than they would have, which is great because your fixed costs in owning a restaurant are what can really kill you because you have to pay your rent every month, right? You know, if nobody comes to the restaurant, you don't have to buy food and you don't have to call in the hourly guys, but you always have to pay your rent. So if real estate's going down, once this thing's over, there's going to be deals to be had and there's going to be people poised to go out there and open some cool new places, I think. I mean, I feel that's definitely going to happen.
Okay, so there are positives and negatives. Yeah.
Well, it's all negative, but there can be some light at the end of this tunnel. I just would have rather have never had to drive through the tunnel.
Yeah. So going back to supporting restaurants, do you have any favorite Baltimore restaurants?
Look, like I said, there's a million guys doing great things. Obviously, the Foreman Wolf Group always satisfies and always executes well. The Atlas Group is doing really great things. The smaller independent guys like Larder and Comptoir de Van, obviously Chad Gauss and his projects are always off the hook. Food Market, La Food Marquetta, you know, Sergio Vitale, Aldo's is the preeminent place. You know, you've got the guys at the Prime Rib always killing it. Jimmy at the Capitol Grill always does a great job. You know, the little places in my neighborhood in Federal Hill, like Bibelos, which is, in my mind, the best Lebanese food in the city. Ed Kim at Me and You Noodle Bar, they're doing great. We go to Jose, who owns the Italian place. I'm blanking. It's right on the corner around my neighborhood. We love that. There's great. I mean, it's, you know, they say it's hard to swing a dead cat and not hit a good restaurant these days in Baltimore. So, there's just a million places to go. I think a lot of times it just depends what you're in the mood for.
Yeah. Before we end, do you have any advice for me as I venture into the culinary world?
Yeah, learn to program video games. I think you're going to do much better. I mean, here's the deal. It's long hours. It's hard work. It's a job where you're working while everybody else is playing. You know, in all the years I own restaurants, I missed all my cousins' weddings, all my aunts and uncles' funerals. It's a business where it's high work and low margin. So you work so hard for so very little.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is if you're bitten by the hospitality bug, there's nothing that can get rid of it. You're going to go do it. You're going to work hard. You're going to have fun. You know, you may not be buying that second home in the Hamptons anytime soon, but it's a very satisfying and very fulfilling career. I mean, there is immediate gratification. There's nothing better than feeding people for the big events in their lives, whether it's birthdays or anniversaries or weddings or even funerals. I mean, you're always there. You're always providing comfort. You're always taking care of people. I mean, we're the only organism on the planet that takes the time to cook and prepare their food in a loving way and sit down and eat it. So I can't say enough about how great the profession is. and how hospitality is a really a true calling. But you know, man, it's gonna be tough. Yeah. I'm not gonna lie.
And my mom says the exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, we always say youth is wasted on the young, but I'll tell you what, old people do know a few things.
Did you just call me old?
I should have said mature, experienced people know a few things. I'm old, so I don't know. You know, I'm an old guy, so there you go.
Before we end, do you have any plugs? Are you starting classes again?
Yeah, you can go to skolacooks.com. Of course, we're keeping them small, 12 people. Mm-hmm. Everybody, unlike the old days where everybody cooked together, everybody's going to cook their own food. Mm. Which, you know, to me, you were there. You saw everybody runs around and rubs elbows. You know, it's going to take a little bit away from the experience that we tried to create. But, you know, the fact of the matter is it will be fun and you will get to cook. And, you know, part of the deal is being in that super big, super tricked out kitchen that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be fun. So, yeah, you can start taking classes. We're still doing private events. That we don't limit the number because we feel that if people know each other, that's everybody in the pandemic talks about knowing your inner circle and who you can interact with. And so private events we're pretty comfortable with. We've done some online stuff, but yeah, we're starting up classes and we're only booking them on the schedule 2 weeks out to see how the pandemic plays out and how we feel, how the classes work. You know, we're doing all the things that the CDC recommends, you know, distancing, hand washing, sanitizing, all that stuff. So, you know, yeah, I think you can go and cook at Skola again. Awesome. It won't be exactly the same, but it'll be fun. And I'm optimistic that by the holidays, maybe it'll be more similar to what you're used to. But yes, you can definitely check it out. And if you want to learn anything about the farm, it's StricklandHollowFarm.com. Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's our website. And it'll tell you, we also host weddings and private events at the barn and do all sorts of things up here. So yeah. And if you want to take a trip, the Catskills are going to be lovely in another 2 weeks. You start to see fall creep in. And so there's nothing better than the Catskill Mountains in the fall.
Awesome. Sounds great. Chef Jerry Pellegrino, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Sammy, it's been a pleasure, man. And good luck. Go do great things. I know you will.
Thank you. You as well.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thank you very much for taking the time to listen to this episode of Hey Chef. This podcast is brought to you by CCBC Student Life's New Media Collective, CCBC's Communication and Media Studies Department, and the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Produced by Beth Bonick and Brian Kim. Artwork by Sammy Bonick and Shannon Design. Theme music by 905 Productions. Thank you to WYPR 88.1 FM, Baltimore's number one news talk station, and WYPR senior producer Bob White for being our studio engineer.